You're with Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, everybody. Trish Wood here. And you are with us on our show called On the Fringe. And I want to find out if any of you watched the January 6th hearings out of Washington this week. It was a remarkable display of what one could only really characterize as, it was a bit of show trial. Shocking in the narrowness and the politicization of this event in Washington on January 6th, right? I mean, I don't think we've got to the bottom of everything that happened that day, but let's not forget that the only people who died were Ashley Babbitt and I believe another woman whose last name is Boyland. There may have been someone else, but the people who died there that day were not the police. Police had a rough time, but you know, Officer Sicknick did not die as a result of what happened that day, even though he lied in state. And the American media is so in the bag on this, right? It was hard for me even to process as I was watching it. I felt like I was in the Soviet Union watching a Pravda exercise. I mean, it was absolutely bizarre. And even the news media were saying like five cops were killed, whatever. I mean, they were just making stuff up. And it, you know, this is a bridge too far. And I'll tell you why it's a bridge too far. The corruption in the media now on behalf of the Democratic Party, and I would say on behalf of all of the left-leaning parties everywhere in Western governments, the media is in the tank. So when you have an event like this, that is being portrayed as bigger than 9/11, the worst day in the history of the country, and they're aiming it specifically at their political opponents, right? The GOP and Donald Trump. That's a very scary thing when the media is in league on something like that. And if you actually do any reading, as I do, I read a lot about this, and I also had Julie Kelly on my regular podcast, which is trishwoodpodcast.com is my website. Trishwood is critical is the show. And she's done more investigative reporting on January 6th than just about anybody else. Oh, the other person who died was a young fellow named Matthew Perna, who committed suicide as a result of the charges. He was there basically trespassing, and he was drummed out of his life and shunned because the propaganda about the people who went to the house that day in protest has been so extreme that anybody connected to it in any way, shape, or form as having their lives ruined. And this poor chap was so destroyed by it. He was apparently a good guy, not even a parking ticket. And he killed himself awaiting charges because he'd been abandoned by his friends, which is what's happening in America right now. So I could not resist playing for you this little bit of tape. Now, they brought in an ABC producer, news producer, but I use that phrase very lightly. Obviously, ABC is no longer a news organization. And he helped them kind of zhuzh it up, you know, spiff it up so it had a real, you know, real kind of razzmatazz instead of it being, you know, the somber actual search for information and facts about that day that would have presented facts on both sides equally and run all the tape they have that they're not showing and taken evidence from people who had other things to say and investigated Ray Epps, who may be connected to the FBI and was the only guy caught on tape, not the only guy, one of the few guys caught on tape actually instructing people to breach the house. And they're not going after him. So anyway, listen to this tape. It's from ABC News.
ABC News special. The seat of democracy attacked. Was there a conspiracy to overthrow an election? Tonight, the search for answers. What exactly happened before?
You'll never take back our country with weakness.
During.
We have stormed the Capitol!
Hey, like this!
All we want is policy!
And after.
We will not be kept out of this chamber by thugs, mobs, or threats.
January 6th will go down as one of the darkest days in recent American history.
Attack on the Capitol. The investigation.
So there you go. It's sort of like a Hollywood production, right? And of course, it's aimed at Donald Trump, regardless of what you think of him. You know, it hardly seems like they're looking for a fair examination of what happened that day. Really, really shocking that the news media all went along with it. This is not good, people. And that kind of corruption on behalf of legacy media is happening everywhere. I mean, it's really bad in America. There's no question. They've crossed the Rubicon at this point. No one even takes them seriously. But it's happening in Canada too. I will say up here, including the wonderful CBC where I used to work, spent much of my career there proudly then, is doing the same thing here to some degree. And it's really a sad thing to watch, because what it means, you know, it's one thing to point it out and say it's wrong and it's bad, but you have to fully take on why it's wrong and it's bad. It's wrong and it's bad because we don't have democracy anymore if we do not have a neutral working media holding them to account and sorting out the information in a neutral way, right? And we don't have that anymore. Something is not a scandal if the media doesn't say it's a scandal, right? So things are only a scandal if the opposition to the current left-leaning or liberal government is saying that. So this is really bad. We're in a really bad spot in history right now, which is why I do this show and my podcast too, because I point, as a former legacy journalist, at a high-profile one, I was a big investigative journalist on CBC, I'm pointing out I can't even really believe what I'm seeing in the industry now. It's just bad. It's really, really bad. So let's move on. And I'm going to do some of the stuff that legacy media should have done about COVID and didn't, which is why it's been such a disaster for everybody. Wouldn't it be great if they started to recognize that everything that happened was wrong? Lockdowns were wrong. School closures were wrong. Masks don't work. You heard Megan Mansell on with me last week explaining why. She knows more about it than anybody because she designs respirators for occupational safety and health in the United States. She's really good at it, right? So nothing these guys did in public health actually made much of a difference. And it has caused grievous harm to millions of people around the world. And some people won't recover from it. They won't recover from it. So what drove those decisions at the beginning, there was a lot of factors, but one of the main factors was the idea that modelers in the UK, namely a guy named Neil Ferguson, who will go down in infamy in my books anyway, was making these wild, wild predictions, you know, modeling predictions, right? And he never released the data. And everybody responded to it anyway, essentially saying, you know, millions would die. When his inputs were finally released publicly, people said, well, this is garbage, right? The old expression, garbage in, garbage out. You can't do a good modeling profile and get an accurate result if the stuff you're putting in is crap. So think about that the whole idea of lockdowns and these heavy duty measures and be afraid, be very afraid, and the case counting and all of that stuff that drove us to madness for 2 years and corrupted every element of our society and our lives was built on data that was simply wrong. So that is one of the other things that people are now starting to look at very, very slowly. By the way, there was a bit of a bump in the UK where they're having some hearings about the modeling and they admit that it didn't work very well. But as usual in this day and age, nobody ever pays a price for these mistakes. Has anybody ever been fired in relation to their COVID mistakes? And I would say about COVID mistakes, it's not just that they made mistakes, people do. And I am a big believer in forgiving people the mistakes they make. But the mistakes in COVID were made because they were so arrogant and so completely enraptured in groupthink with their own wonderfulness as a tribe of kind of technocratic bureaucrats that guys like Neil Ferguson go on, he'll be doing predictions for the next pandemic, probably, and people will forget he got this wrong and he got mad cow disease wrong. He got a lot of stuff wrong and he still has this big career. I don't get it. So we're going to look at modeling today, and we're super lucky to have William Shadwick and Anna Cascone, who are esteemed mathematicians in the world. And they are going to help us make our way through a pretty complex subject, but they're getting pretty good at actually simplifying. I tell them, I've interviewed them once before, and I told them to explain it as if they were talking to a drunk baby. I failed math. It was my worst subject. But don't be intimidated by what they're going to say, because the other thing they bring to the table, which is so important, is a criticism of not just the modeling itself and the math that led into the modeling, but the way this was handled by public health and how this reliance on a flawed system could go on for so long and go on as long as it did without anybody really calling it out, not for quite a while. So they're coming up in a minute. I'm going to throw to a break now so we don't just kind of get them going in a conversation and have to break. So let's take a break. This is Trish Wood. You're with TNT Radio, today's News Talk Radio.
Dolores Cahill on TNT Radio.
Well, that is astounding, Alex. Now, I have, you know, not really spoken about the issue of carbon dioxide and climate change on the show as yet, but I've been researching it for more than 10 years. So it's maybe if you know, I suppose it's a bit like the so-called pandemic. Partly, we will have other shows where we look at the fundamental question, is carbon dioxide a driver of climate change, which it isn't. And also, nobody, of course, is saying climate change doesn't exist. It's what are the causes and can anything we do change it? What kind of corruption did you uncover, Alex?
I find that at the moment, many of us are getting, I guess, divided.
You're totally right, because part of the questions that they use to divide us distracts us from what they're doing and the solutions. Absolutely.
Weekends with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
A lot of people may not agree with us right now, but there may come a time when they actually have an issue that affects them, that they don't have the freedom to choose. And if we don't preserve it, we won't have it.
Get to see this for yourself.
We begin this new week with an extraordinary moment in our history. 18 days into this truck convoy, and the federal government invoked a security measure that goes beyond anything seen in this country in the last 50 years.
Banks will be told to freeze the accounts of anyone helping finance the protests. And the owners of vehicles jamming streets will be directly targeted.
Trucking for Freedom, Chapter 1, How We Got Here. Visit truckingforfreedom.com.
As an organ donor, your story doesn't have to end. The good in you can live on. In fact, you could save up to 8 lives and restore sight and health for many more. Sign up right now online as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. You'll be happy you did. And just maybe, someone else will be happy too. Go to organdonor.gov. It saves lives. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
When you need to know what's going on around the world and at home, keep it on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. TNT.
Gee, I loved hearing about our great Canadian truckers in that break. That's wonderful. And also what Dolores Cahill said about the idea that they are dividing us with all of these red herring deals. I completely agree with that. I think she's absolutely spot on. I enjoy those things. Okay, let's get to Bill Shadwick and Anna Cascone. I want to start by asking you, Bill, I'll start with you. You know, obviously, numbers and mathematics are the key to the whole public health response to COVID-19. Tell me your assessment of how well or how badly, I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway, about how well or how badly they did, the modelers.
Yeah, even the modelers now, let's focus on England. That's our business is based there. We're in Brazil now, as you know, but we've been looking very carefully at what's going on there. We've been communicating sporadically with the head of the modeling group that fed the scenarios, et cetera, to SAGE, which talked to the government and ultimately made these decisions. And what he says is, and he's said this in published articles and interviews, we're not actually trying to make predictions. We're showing you scenarios or forecasts that don't mean this will happen. It's a range of things that might happen if you do this or you do that. And bizarrely, that's exactly the position that Sunetra Gupta takes, who's been on the other side of all of these things. Where they would disagree is in whether or not these predictions of or these scenarios actually connect to the real world. And she says, well, it's been proven now because they failed to come true in the spring of 2021. They're simply wrong. They don't do the job. But we've been thinking a lot about this. And the issue of the modeling, I think, is that it's not the right. They weren't asking, no one was asking the right questions. These people are providing the right answers to the wrong questions. It's not that their calculations aren't correct. It's just that they're not relevant. They don't answer the when we started looking at this, we were looking at modeling cases and modeling deaths and so on. And partly because of the lags and gaps in the data, and partly because we realized it was much more important, we switched to looking at hospital admissions. And in fact, if you think about it for a second, the only thing that matters during an epidemic is how many people are seriously ill, how many people will require admission to hospital. We have actually very few hospital beds, you know, for the number of people that are in any of the Western countries.
Yeah.
700 per 100,000 in Japan, almost 800 per 100,000 in Japan. That's vastly more than other countries have. Canada doesn't have more than Brazil, or more than the state of Rio, say. Brazil as a whole, it varies from state to state. The rich states have more. But 200,000 or 300,000 or 200 or 300 hospital beds per 100,000 people is in the high end around the world. So if any significant proportion of the population actually needs to go to a hospital, we're in tremendous trouble. But of course, that never happened. It never happened.
Bill, I want to just go back to something you said and maybe expand on that a little bit. And that is the idea that they're saying, well, you know, these were just different scenarios. They weren't actually predictions. But here's the problem with that idea, in my view. Once you hand a public health bureaucrat a document that says the low end is X and the high end is Y, and the high end is really, really high, then aren't they, in a sense, not morally bound, but there's a great impetus there for a whole bunch of reasons for them to operate only on the worst case scenario. Now, those worst case scenarios weren't even close to being true. They were insanely off the mark. But isn't it a problem in handing people worst case scenarios? Because then that's how they're going to program, how they're going to decide what their response should be. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, what we should have been concentrating on is what we've done. And I've accomplished this, finding a way to make actual predictions about numbers that are reasonably accurate enough so that you can make plans based on. And our predictions don't come with there's no way for us to produce confidence intervals for these things. There's not some cloud of possible numbers. We're telling you there will be this many people admitted to hospital next week. And we know that number isn't going to be exactly right. It may be wrong by 25%. It may only be wrong by 10%.
10%.
Right? If you were administering a hospital and you knew what you were faced with next week, up to plus or minus 25%, you should be able to do the job, assuming that resources were being provided to you. And there's been no hint anywhere in the world that unwillingness to provide resources was the reason for these panic reactions. We had those hospital ships in New York. We had tent hospitals in Canada and in England and Rio near our place here.
Not used.
People were willing to put those
not
things,
used.
And they were
not
used.
Used.
They were never
not used.
Needed.
Not used. Right. That ship sat in New York Harbor. Sorry, that ship sat in New York Harbor.
I think there were even two ships, weren't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was the Comfort and the Mercy, I think, yeah.
And so, of course, if... So this is, we have some good news, right? We have some very good news because there will be more. There will be more outbreaks of COVID-19. We've just seen what almost certainly indicates a new one starting in England right now.
Okay, and I want to get to what you figured out and what the future is and what's going on in England right now a little farther down the road, because
sure.
I think it's really, really important for people to understand what happened and how this happened, since although there is some accountability in various places, in the UK for sure and other places, there's not much. Like, they just kind of did a hit and run and now nobody's talking about it. So, and I want to ask you, I guess the general question, because I'm sure you've thought about it a lot, how did this happen? How did so many modelers, and it wasn't just Neil Ferguson either, there's the crew out in at the University of Washington also, how did this particular specialty get it so wrong for so long and be given massive credibility by public health while they were doing it? How did it happen?
Well, I'm going to be frank with you. It's a question of corruption of science. Neil Ferguson is a good example. He did a PhD in physics and never published anything. And then he goes to be the modeler and he makes mistakes and mistakes and mistakes, and it's not accountable for it. And the kind of mistakes these people do is not small mistakes. The minimum on the scenario, the macro scenario, the difference is huge. How can anybody... Of course, the politicians also has something to blame there, because you look at the scenarios and you see the minimum and maximum so different. You have to suspect that this tool is not good. The politicians have a responsibility of analyzing the tools and see if it makes sense. Like, you're not a scientist. Jeffrey Tucker is not a scientist. And all you guys read the stuff and say, that doesn't make sense. Well, there's a lack of this, doesn't make sense. And the modelers have the school of modeling where everybody agrees with everybody. They're doing the same little improvements on each other's work for a century now. And there's, for example, a group supposedly to study influenza and never noticed the behavior of influenza the way we did. They never get anything. How many years, how many salaries they've been paid for that?
That's a good point. I mean, there should not be any low-hanging fruit left to pick in the subject of, for example, the Spanish flu pandemic. And there was. We found things that changed the way that has to be interpreted. And nobody noticed, because they don't look at data generally.
We worked for 2 years on this. We never work on this stuff. We just look at the same and say, let's look at the data with a fresh eye. The data has to be the guideline. And the other models are not really looking at the data. They're looking at models all the time, and models over models. If the models agree with them, the thing is ridiculous. The whole school of modeling, epidemiologist modeling, is ridiculous.
It needs to be looked at very carefully. Because, I mean, for example,
let me just say this, Bill. Bill, I'll come to you in a second, but I just wanted to say this, that essentially what you're saying is, and I didn't know this, but I know it now because I spoke to you before about it, but that I thought these modelers were mathematicians like you. I thought that they were kind of number crunching in some really sophisticated way. And if I'm reading you correctly, that is false. So what are they basing those? Is it like voodoo? What are they basing those predictions on, if not mathematical calculations?
They are mathematical calculations, but here's an example.
But done by people that don't understand mathematics.
Yeah, there's not a, there's not a tremendously strong understanding of
that. There's a whole thing in medicine and this and that, that people apply statistics. And the kind of statistics these people apply, they publish papers, those patients have more probability of dying if they eat that or that. I mean, have 40 cases with very, very...
There's a lower level of...
Lower level analysis.
There's lower bar in subjects outside the physical sciences and engineering. And you know, it gets very low in things like sociology. It's probably higher in economics than it is in epidemiology. But in both cases, you have to be very, very, wary about predictions. You know, there's this thing called the Laffer curve in economics. It tells you, apparently Laffer drew it on a napkin at a dinner table one night. It tells you that if you raise taxes, if you start with zero tax, you get zero revenue. If you raise taxes to the point where they're 100%, it'll get zero revenue. But in between, it goes up, and then it goes down again. Well, that's a concept, right? Which everybody can say makes sense. But if I was to come to you and say, I can tell you exactly how much tax revenue you'll have if you tweak this the sales tax by this much, the personal tax by that much, and the corporation tax and dividend tax by this much and this much. And I can predict those things. Well, that's insane. It's not going to work. But you could you can't test that easily because you can't do those things. The out that the modelers have always used is that there's no way to do experiments. You know, that would be immoral to do controlled experiments during an epidemic. So test your modeling. Well, in the absence of experiments, as astronomers have known for millennia, you can do observations and ask whether your predictions agree with the observations. And, you know, there's this wonderful thing where Richard Feynman lecturing in his inimitable style, saying it doesn't matter how beautiful your model is, it doesn't matter how famous you are, if it doesn't agree with experiment, it's wrong. And the experiment here is the observations. It has to agree with the data. Now, unfortunately, they've put a lot of distance between themselves and the data, and they actually know this. During the Ebola outbreak, they were badly embarrassed by the enormously wrong predictions they made about how many millions of people would be affected.
I know.
And their response to that was to do a modeling challenge to try to see whose models would actually give more accurate results. And they published these things. And it's very telling the way they describe the thing. They say, literally, one of the prominent modelers in the paper about this said, we got these things wrong. Well, those big overestimates might be good for advocacy. They could lose us credibility. Now, if you have a science that judges its results by how useful they are for advocacy, that's not a science, right? It's no longer science. That's something you can get away with even imagining.
It's messaging.
And to do their competition,
right? It becomes
messaging. Yes, that's so. And so it's based on assumptions. You have things that look like they're simple, innocuous assumptions, but when you look a little bit more closely, you realize that assumption is completely unrealistic. Like the idea of susceptibility. How many people are, how do you know if somebody's going to be susceptible to COVID? Well, we didn't know. Canada had practically no COVID compared to other countries, Ontario especially. Why? Yeah. Probably because of some residual immunity left over from the first SARS. But right. Nobody could possibly say accurately what's the susceptible population in Canada. They can't say how transmissible it is. All of these things are essential components of the model. And you can't, you know, so you can make those numbers up. You can't measure them. You might be able to sort of measure them after the fact. But you can't do it in advance. So that this should never have been tried. What they should have been doing was to ask, what's the best way we have of predicting how many people will be in hospital next week? You're just counting what happened. And it turns out you can do that quite well. Yeah. That's what we've
The idea is you observe the data and then you try to make conclusions. And it turns out that we can conclude things.
Now, it would be great if we could come up with some way that said, look, we know we can predict.
We can control the virus.
We can control the virus. This is what you have to do. Nobody, that doesn't make any sense, right? Like all these other things that came from this test and trace nonsense. Great for sexually transmitted diseases. Totally ridiculous to even try it for a respiratory virus. 37 billion pounds was what they spent on that nonsense in England.
Oh, I know. Well, and especially when the cat's out of the bag, right? I mean, test and trace might work in the first like 2 weeks or something, but after that,
it's airborne.
Shut up.
No, I walk by you in the street, right?
Yeah.
How are you going to trace that?
Yeah, I'm sort of revved up though. I have to tell you why, because the longer we go from the way we were forced to live in the last 2 years and how frustrated and upset all of us were at watching the swaths of destruction that were wrecked across, you know, virtually every, except Sweden, every Western country. I guess my question to you is, and I want you to be blunt, what does not just the mistakes that they made in the modeling, but the acceptance of those mistakes and the non-accountability for the people who made those mistakes, what does that say about where we are? I had Chris Bray on last week. If you're not reading his Substack, you should be. It's magnificent. And he said that, you know, after years of being an essayist and a writer, never has he seen a group of people like the kind of ruling elite, and I include in that the bureaucrats and all the science people and stuff, who are more keen to pat each other in the back in the face of a great and historic level failure. But they do. There's something about these people now, I can't put my finger on it, but that's really not working.
Well, how about second rate? I mean, these are not. Look around and let's see. Do you really think Peter Juni is the top of the pile, intellectually speaking? For example,
yeah.
Do you really think that a couple of medical doctors
should be the head should be scientists. The
two Britain's top scientists as they're called?
Yeah,
they're
both top doctors
were trained
here.
As doctors, right?
Yeah.
And one of them worked in a drug company at a high level. That doesn't make you a scientist. How can the chief scientist advising a country with 60 million people in it be a guy who's got a medical degree and worked for a drug company? Now, in the past, the chiefs, you know, they've had chief scientists like Herman Bondi after the Second World War. He's a phenomenally important physicist. But you just imagine, what you should do is imagine Richard Feynman talking to any of these people and asking them to explain why we should be doing what they think. And there's just no conceivable way that.
Richard Feynman everybody knows about him because of the Discovery film, right? With John Hurt.
Explain who he is, Anna.
Yes. He's this wonderful physicist that was very popular because he was very creative and fun at playing bongo, whatever, playing school samba in Brazil. And he had a Nobel Prize, of course. I don't know how many. But when the discovery exploded, they hired him to figure out why. And then they made this film that I think everybody watched with John Hurt and Ben Feynman, and he discovered that they used this rubber gasket that couldn't stand low temperatures.
Yeah.
And when Discovery was launched, it was cooler than usual. It was just that simple, as simple as that. But the whole, I think everybody knows who he is because of that film. I mean, he, and the, every scientist knows who he is, of course. But anyway.
I love that story. I actually used that story. I did a Heroes show on Trish Wood is Critical, and I used the story of him because he, that's such a good example, Anna. Wow, I love that because he, you know, they wanted to launch. The deal was they wanted to launch, and the O-rings, they also knew over a certain, under a certain temperature, became, I guess, rigid, right, and would crack apart.
Very brittle,
Very brittle, and he knew that, and he, you know, he said, we got, you know, Houston, we got a problem, as they say, and they launched anyway, and of course, it exploded, and all those poor people died. And then, he did, it's one of those moments where the whistleblower psychology in the face of all of this stuff seems so heroic. We're going to go to a break, and then we're going to come back and do more with Bill Shadwick and Anna Cascone on the failure of modeling and science and public health more generally in this kind of semi-post-COVID world. Back in a minute.
We have a national day for the victims of communism. It's now time to have a national day for the victims of lockdowns.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Today is the national day to commemorate the victims of communism, and that includes more than 100 million people who have been killed in some 40 nations governed by a communist party.
That's right. Along the same lines, I believe it's now time for a launch of the annual Victims of Lockdown Day to memorialize the evil and destructive and ineffective government COVID lockdown policies that spread worldwide in 2020-2021. Delayed medical treatments, economic destruction, suicide, drug addiction, kids stifled learning, masking, vax mandates, canceled weddings, funerals, the list goes on and on. It's time to recognize the victims of lockdown. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
As an Olympic athlete, I prepare for everything. So when I became pregnant, I thought I was ready. But at 32 weeks, I was diagnosed with severe preeclampsia and had an emergency C-section. Looking back, had I known the warning signs, I would have talked to my doctor sooner. Too many women die of pregnancy-related complications, and most are preventable. If you or someone you know is pregnant or recently had a baby, learn the warning signs. It could help save her life. Hear her.
The PCR test for monkeypox. Another crap PCR test for another crap virus. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I love that.
Me too. That's putting it bluntly, isn't it? And I love the idea of Victims of Lockdowns Day. I will totally co-sign that and bring the receipts because I've been collecting those stories. So we were just talking, Bill and Anna, about the total and utter collapse of scientific credibility, and but not just credibility, scientific accountability, right? They're still patting themselves on the back. No one's saying sorry. I mean, it's just incredible that they aren't. And I know you guys are like, not just, you have this new idea for counting, which we're going to talk about in about 15 seconds, but you're also really, really good critics of what happened here and how this happened. Because I, you know why I do this? I want our listeners to understand they are not insane, right? That you know, they obviously people have been watching, they've been seeing the headlines, oh, Neil Ferguson, oh, millions will die, and then it doesn't happen. And all these things happen that make no sense. Warnings about how bad the lockdowns were going to be. All these things they were warned about, they happened anyway, and nobody's being held accountable. And that creates cognitive dissonance, and I will add trauma in the minds of our fellow citizens. It really, really does. We feel we're living in an upside-down world. So you guys are so... so skilled and gifted in mathematics that, you know, to me, to have you saying, you know, wow, this really was a big failure. This is a big thing for me. Like I'm really, you know, it's like the whistleblowing person in the space shuttle. It's kind of the same because I bet you people aren't very happy with you right now.
Well, we don't really.
No. Nobody.
They're not paying a lot of attention.
They just ignore us.
We published this paper. We put it up on Boxing Day, so it got revealed to the world on the preprint server, the Med Archive preprint server on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And we've been writing to all the mathematicians, to politicians, to everybody. People just don't answer. They ignore
it. They don't want to. So you said something, and I want to ask you about this too. You said something in the last time I talked to you that really blew my mind, and that is that the modeling was so bad that at the time that most of these lockdowns and things were implemented, actually, you know, like at the height of it, it was actually, it had already been receding. So it's kind of a mug's game, right? They can put in a lockdown and then they notice through their faulty modeling it's receding, but it already was receding anyway, and then claim credit that the lockdowns work, right? That's really astonishing for me.
Go ahead.
No, that's, and in fact, that's exactly what happened. But you can see in retrospect, once you know when the deaths peaked, you know, you can work backwards and figure out when the infections must have peaked. It's basically about 3 weeks previously. The infections had to peak before the deaths could peak. And it takes about 3 weeks between when someone who ends up being fatally hit by the disease is infected and when they finally succumb to it.
Yeah. So let's talk about what you discovered, okay? Because it's important, and I know that you two have been trying to get the word out, but listen, they don't want to know about it, and as I keep haranguing, the media is not interested in this, in anything that defiles the COVIDian narrative, right? So yeah. So let's talk about what you've discovered is a very valuable thing, and that is a way to predict what's actually going to happen. You've been doing these predictions just on your own and finding out your method is correct, right? So yes. What are you trying to achieve with this? What do you want to do?
Well, so the first step was to go back through all the data we could find in history to make sure that it does work. And then we've been doing it in real time since
what we're trying to achieve is getting people to stop being scared when it's not necessary. They should know there is a number that's correct, that's predictive. When the number rises and they need to take act on it, like put a tent hospital or something like that, they do. But they don't spend money when it's not necessary. Yeah. And they should realize that things are not as bad as they've been saying it is, because we can predict the numbers are not never high the way people have been saying. So that's two things we're trying to do. Avoid spend money when it's not necessary and decrease the fears. And so the lockdowns and all these measures, they actually, as you mentioned, prove not to be effective, because they all be made after the peak of the infections.
I think the most important point of this is that once you know it's predictable, that removes any possible rationale for extreme society-destroying measures.
Yeah.
There's no excuse for doing that anymore.
Yeah.
If you'd known what you were facing, none of this nonsense would ever have happened. But it was the fear that it's not only their unknown, but unknowable numbers of people might show up at the emergency room.
Yeah.
That paralyzed everyone all over the world. It's still going on in China.
Yeah, well, there were those terrible pictures too out of, Italy was bad and New York City had a moment, right? But you know, and people were so like this, it's like a pandemic of the non-specific, right? There's all this specific information we had about who got it, how old they were, how sick they were, who it was going to affect. That was completely ignored in the public health policy, right? Everybody was just kind of governing by, oh, those pictures out of New York where they were digging in Potter's Field, a mass grave. We better, you know, out here in Utah, really do, you know, I mean, it's just, that is the frustrating thing for me, and I'm sure for you too, that the actual data, the knowables, right? Yes. From guys like John Ioannidis and the Diamond Princess data, which was hugely important and ignored, would have given them a much better roadmap. And so they threw away what was knowable to go with what was unknowable, namely this crappy modeling.
Yes.
And the costs, like, I can't even wrap my head around.
Yeah, the cost to society is just staggering. It's going to take decades for this to be.
The direct indirect cost, the two kinds, just, right?
Yes.
They're both horrible.
So, the facts that were available were, for example, hospital admissions. So in Europe, probably because of some EU directive, the number of people admitted to hospital is known 2 days later. Why it takes 2 days, who knows, right? It shouldn't take any time at all.
Yeah.
It's all being entered into a computer. That you can't get into a hospital without somebody at a keyboard typing your name and number and so on, and diagnosis into a database. But anyway, it's there with a lag of 2 days. Well, 2 days is not that much time. You could, if you spent a lot less than they spent on test and trace, you could probably easily get that down to same day. But it was known within 2 days. And those are real numbers. They don't, unlike in Ontario, where they can be revised for weeks after the fact. In Europe, these numbers are known with a lag of only 2 days, and they don't change in the future. So you know exactly what you would have been looking at. And you can predictable.
See, that's predictable. You guys told me a story about somebody getting sick. Was it in Antarctica?
That shows that we know absolutely nothing about how viruses, especially coronaviruses, are transmitted.
Tell the story.
So there's this exhibition in Antarctica, and the time they were very serious and had this military doctor with them taking notes, absolutely precise about. How long ago was the exhibition?
The expedition was in 1973.
Okay, so they were all very in good shape, healthy, being attested by the doctor, etc. Suddenly, after 17 weeks isolated, completely isolated in Antarctica, they had an outbreak of a coronavirus, common cold. So
somebody got the first cold.
Right. Yeah. So how is that even impossible?
Who should he have isolated himself from?
Yeah, I mean,
right?
it's ludicrous.
But it's
because it's clear to me that the virus lives inside us.
But what's absolutely unarguable is we don't understand transmission.
Yeah.
Saying that you can model it by sticking a couple of parameters into a bunch of equations is crazy. It's simply not true.
It's not true. Okay, Bill, so now we're running a little bit out of time, so I want you to, I stopped you from doing this at the beginning because I wanted to kind of end with the future. So you're seeing an uptick in Britain again, I guess, of cases, and I suspect there'll be upticks as seasonal is going to come back probably. So what are you seeing? And then I'm going to want you, I want you to just say how anybody who's listening to this show who wants to talk to these people about their model, they've got to get in touch and do it. So why don't we do that first? So how do they get a hold of you guys?
Just Omega Analysis, all one word, at protonmail.com is our email.
Okay. And give me like a minute and a half, if you can, on what you see ticking up now and how accurate you think your prediction is.
So what we've found is that just like influenza cycles, the waves of COVID-19 follow two different types of behavior. There's the outbreak behavior, which we can predict, and then there's the endemic behavior in between the two. And for the first year, COVID followed exactly the flu cycles of locations, which are more complicated than people had realized. But now it's on a different clock, it seems. In addition to the flu cycles locations, it seems to be running at about a month of off time, down season, instead of this whole summer like it always used to be. in the flu and other respiratory diseases. It seems it's about a month. And Omicron hit the UK at the beginning of December. It ran till late February. About a month later, it started again and ran until the 7th of May. And then it started again, as far as we can see, last week. So we've got another, So we're now believe that we've started another phase with it. And this is, these are variants, right? This is the second one was the BA2. That will have been replaced by something else. And on we go. So this looks like it could be about the same size as the last two, which means about 100,000 people roughly going into hospital in England, which has a population of, you know, 60 million. So it's not, this isn't an enormous chunk of the population. Of course.
But the NHS is terrible, apparently.
But the NHS is terrible. Yeah, absolutely.
It's terrible.